If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Today is Thursday. It's Thursday. Doesn't have the same ring, does it, Eric Zorn? It is February 18th, 2016. I'm John Williams, and here's a Thursday edition of The Mincing Rascals with Eric Zorn, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Hello, EZ.
I'm here, John.
Oh, it's got to stop.
We've got to find a new way to start these podcasts. On a phone line from beautiful Springfield, Illinois, where she's been sent for bad behavior, is Kristen McQuarrie. Hi, Kristen. How are you?
I'm fine, and yes, let's please not sing the day.
That's,
and then she does.
She's the editorial writer and sometimes columnist for the Tribune, there for Rahner's budget address. We'll get to that shortly. We're glad you're on the phone. Steve Bertrand's in the WGN Tribune studios. He's, of course, from WGN Radio. Hi, Steve.
Hello, John Williams.
Antonin Scalia has died since we all last recorded a podcast, and the world has changed a little bit since then. Steve, this Hollywood script keeps getting more and more unbelievable, doesn't it?
More Hollywooder?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And so Sandra Day O'Connor, now the Reagan appointee, the first woman on the bench, is saying, come on, Senate, you got to get along with this and do your job. Yeah, it's amazing to me. I don't know how this is all going to play, but the that Mitch McConnell, I've heard 10 minutes.
Less than
an hour or two after it was announced, said, don't bother sending replacement, and which was just bad form, I think. I mean, it might be the way they're going to play it, but my God, let's celebrate. Even though I didn't agree with a lot of his decisions, give the guy his due.
Yeah. Well, if I had to bet, and now I'm jumping the gun here, but I don't think there's any way that the Senate approves any nominee of the president before January. You agree with me on that?
I don't know. Depending on who he nominates, and there have been some, senators starting to give themselves a little wiggle room on it. If he comes up, I mean, I'd like to see them work together and get a consensus candidate, right? That would be the ideal. And I think that might still happen, because I think if they don't, I think it really works against the Republicans. I think long term, it's going to do them, short term, I should say, it will do them more damage than if they hold off and fight it.
It was just an unserious thing to do, I thought, coming out that quickly and saying no way, no how. That, it's one of these, you wait a couple of days and you let the news sink in, and then you say, well, of course we're going to do our duty. Of course we're going to.
Yeah, and then don't.
And then when it comes along, you say, well, this candidate is clearly unacceptable. I mean, it's just the kind of thing that you whisper to one another in the cloakroom.
Yeah, jumping the gun doesn't buy you any advantage. What's the point of that?
I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you guys, but it struck me as a bookend, right? Because McConnell was known for, at the very beginning of Obama's administration, saying what we're going to do here is do everything we can to see that he doesn't win a second term. And now at the end of his second term, or toward it, he's saying, well, this term is basically over and we're going to do everything we can to keep him from exercising the powers of his office.
But I don't want to go down that road, because Chuck Schumer said things before that will haunt Democrats, and Ronald Reagan said things that would encourage us to look past partisan politics when we're picking a judge. So,
Barack Obama was involved in delaying one of
Alito.
Exactly.
Yeah, he filibustered Alito.
So. But I don't know. Either side can find fuel for their fire if they look far enough back. I really think, of course, this is me having voted for Obama and wanting his appointee to be on the Supreme Court. But I'll still finish this statement. I think we should live in the present. The president has a duty, and the Senate has an obligation to at least consider it. If they don't at least hold hearings and a thumbs up or thumbs down vote, I think that's an abdication of their duties.
Vice President Biden was in your neck of the woods
this week,
and he was talking about that, about how it would be irresponsible not to choose someone, how we'd like to see a consensus. And the consensus name I keep hearing is one that you might be familiar with, Amy Klobuchar.
Klobuchar is her name,
yeah. She's the senator from Minnesota.
Very moderate, very good at working across the aisle. Her demeanor is so friendly. She's a perfect Minnesotan that way.
What does Justice McQuarrie think about this?
Yeah, no kidding.
Conspicuously,
I think she hung up
silent.
A long time ago.
She's having another horseshoe.
I actually agree with John that, you know, I understand Republicans wanting to wait for the next president because there are cases before the Supreme Court right now that could now tip in a different direction if Obama gets to make an appointment. But you know what? That's life. And I mean, some of these cases, one that I'm watching closely is a Friedrichs case of a California teacher who doesn't want to pay union dues. And there's been a lot of belief that it would strike down forced paying of even those fair share union dues. That is something Scalia would have probably sided with this California teacher. Now that case could be up for grabs as well as some others. But I agree with John that you can't, I mean, we know Washington politicizes everything. We know Mitch McConnell politicizes everything. I don't think they're going to do the right thing, but I think the right thing is to at least go through the appointment process.
You don't think we'll get a new appointee before January?
No.
It's going to be a lot harder on the Republicans when there's an actual face, when there's someone who has been nominated, and you know that whoever is nominated is going to have pretty good credentials. And is not going to be someone who's
right, like that Sri Sivanathan guy, the 48-year-old Indian American who was approved 97-0 to a federal court. The entire Senate has already weighed in on his credentials unanimously.
And stalling or rejecting that nomination simply because it came from Barack Obama is just not going to look good.
And won't that hurt them? In the elections?
It's going to look great to half of the country who identify themselves as Republicans and don't want to see the appointment. I mean, I don't think people, as we go through these primaries, are going to be paying that close of attention to a held up Supreme Court nominee. We don't pay attention to held up attorney general nominees or many other appointments who have gone before the Senate and they sit on them. So
I think they're going to pay attention to this one, though, don't you?
And if you listen to the president's words, he keeps saying he's going to nominate someone in due time, which tells me that he's not going to rush it, knowing that he probably won't get approved. And so it will be a summertime issue.
I think
it's bad for the Republicans in the November election if they're the ones seeing not living up to the constitutional requirement.
But I want to make sure I understand Kristen correctly. Are you saying that you don't think this is going to be an election issue, Kristen?
I don't think it's going to be that prominent where it's going to make people switch their votes in a presidential race because the Senate Republicans are sitting on a Supreme Court nominee.
I agree with that. I don't think they're going to switch votes. I think what may happen, though, is that it may motivate one side or the other to vote more. And this is why this is such an interesting thing to have happen, which is that to me, the Supreme Court is always a huge issue in every election. And I have a memory that last week after the podcast, Steve, you and I and Kristen were talking about the Supreme Court and why isn't it a bigger issue? We were just talking on the way to the elevator. Why isn't it a bigger issue in these elections? Because it is so important to the direction of the country who's on the Supreme Court. And yet, in survey after survey, voters don't put that very high. This year, it's going to be a really big concern. And I think it's going to motivate a lot of people to come out and vote. I don't know which side right now, but I think what you're suggesting, John and Steve, is that it's going to motivate Democrats because they're going to be more outraged to come out and vote.
I think it's going to hurt Republicans with independent voters if you can make the case nationally, whether it's Senate races or the race for president next September and October, that here's a party that isn't living up to the Constitution and is doing whatever it can to, you know, thwart the will of the people. I mean, look, the Democrats may well do it as well or would have done it as well. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying I don't think it's going to play well for them in the election.
Plus, if Barack Obama does give them at least a somewhat passable moderate, right? He's not going to put a conservative up, but if he puts up a moderate, maybe they would be wise to take that now rather than gamble. What if Hillary wins? Well, then and she's got 4 years to sit on some appointments. At some point, they're going to have to deal with it then. Maybe better to deal with it now and get somebody palatable.
Or President Sanders nominates Michael Moore. Right?
No, the real kick in the face would be if Hillary nominated Barack, which would be like, we can't get rid of these people. But the reason this issue is really going to stick around is because, as we all know, Antonin Scalia was murdered by the Obama administration. They put a hit out on him. And that explains how he was found in his bed with his clothes hardly wrinkled and a pillow, quote unquote, over his face. And you believe the amount of conspiracy theories that have spun out of that and how, I'm sorry, here we go with our Donald Trump part of the show, Trump just wove it right into the Michael Savage interview. Savage actually brought it up, but Trump was happy to sort of abet that conversation and say, yeah, I've been hearing these things. It sounds troubling. Gee, that's really weird, that sort of thing. So I think he was probably killed by the Obamas, so that I don't know exactly how that works out, but at least there's a thread out there in the internet about how that conspiracy goes. Steve, I presume that's your lead story today on WGN Radio?
It has been all day, that and the serial stowaway back in court. Well, I don't know what to say to that, because are you surprised? I'm not surprised at all. I mean, people, we should have learned for the past 50 years, but certainly in the past 6 months, that people will believe just about anything.
I don't know. I do talk radio for a living. I'm always looking for an interesting angle. I can never come up with ones as good as these crazy people. And even if I could, I don't think I would say it out loud.
Well, the thing is, then you can't prove them wrong, because, you can't prove a conspiracy theory wrong, and it just lives forever. They drive me crazy.
Hillary Clinton, by the way, let's segue over to, are we done talking about the presidential candidates? Any surprises?
You're a liar. You're a liar.
Yeah, that is the thing, by the way. You know, we're talking about whether or not the Supreme Court justice issue will resonate in the election. I think Kristen's right. Who's going to change their vote from Republican to Democrat about this? Maybe nobody. But I think that at some point, if the Republicans continue to call each other and the Democrats liars, but it's coming out of their mouths, at some point, the lasting effect is going to be that you're going to think, oh, yeah, Republicans, what did I hear? Oh, yeah, they're liars. Where did I get that, Will? Cruz and Trump and Rubio all said that about Cruz and Trump and Rubio. And so even though they're trying to score individual points, they're so damaging the brand that I think that's really bad for their party right now. I trust Kristen, you agree with that assessment too.
I do. I mean, I feel like we're getting into the, although we're already in the circus, now we're in, second act. And so you're just going to see these candidates say anything to try to get a moment of attention. They are going to damage whoever emerges as the nominee if they keep going down this road.
Yeah.
I was interested to note that Cruz is now leading in one national poll. Trump has led in every national poll going all the way back. Cruz, I think, just in Wednesday with the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, has Cruz in the lead. I thought that was interesting. Apparently, things are just very, very close for the Democrats in Nevada, it looks like, things are just up for grabs. A couple of things struck me. One, I thought Kasich gave a really good interview this week to Chris Matthews. I don't know if anybody saw that.
I did, yeah. Bits and pieces.
He sort of stayed above the fray. He describes himself as trying to drive around the accidents at the debates, he may be poised to do well if he can keep in the ball game. And it looks like Jeb Bush is just not going to ever get that traction.
No,
Kasich is betting on the Midwest, right?
So he wants for sure. By the way, I do have the list of people, famous people who support Donald Trump. Tell me if this is an endorsement or a damnation. All of the people have come on record as saying they support Donald Trump. Gary Busey, Ted Nugent, Dennis Rodman, Stephen Baldwin, Mike Tyson, Jesse Ventura, Charlie Sheen. This is a parade of the crazy, isn't it? Mike Ditka, Terrell Owens. Here's one that surprises me a little bit. Cher, because I know she's kind of a rebel, but I thought she was, I'll just say it, smarter than that. Mark Cuban, Kenny Rogers, Chuck Yeager, Tom Brady, Gene Simmons, and Howard Stern. So there's the parade of people for Donald Trump.
Wow.
Vote accordingly. Hillary Clinton came out against, of all things, Governor Rauner's, budget. Kristen, did that resonate at all in Springfield? Did you all hear that? The speeches were going on simultaneously, but she sure took a shot at Governor Rauner.
Yeah, who cares what Hillary Clinton says, honest to God, go back to New York, where you've lived for the past 20 years, stay out of our mess, and acknowledge that it's your party who got us here. So
what do you
I don't
think?
Really give, you know what I'm going to, I can't swear.
Two hoots, as my mom would say.
There
well, then
you
what,
go.
Why would she bring that up? Why did she come all the way to Illinois to take a shot at Rauner? What's your thought on that?
I'm sure somebody asked her. I'm sure it was a reporter who you know, had a moment with her and wanted to know her thoughts. And she had the talking points down perfectly. I mean, she could have just been a little mouthpiece for Mike Madigan's Democratic Party. Or
I was wondering about that. I thought, how does she know these issues and these players that well? She can't be following Illinois state politics. So it did seem a little hand-fed to me.
I don't think she was asked questions, Kristen. I might be wrong on that, but I don't know if she took questions.
No, she was giving an address, and she just said, oh, what was the line? I'll pull it up for you. But
it fits in her counter-argument against, or in her sort of trying to co-opt some Sanders supporters, doesn't it?
I mean, yeah, well, she's trying to raise money. You're right, she needs to take a hard line. I also thought that part of the agenda was that she's trying to distance herself from her moneyed contributors, you know, from the big banks and brokers. And so if she takes a shot at him, I don't know, maybe that somehow somebody connects those dots.
Kristen, you were there for that speech. Did you hear much that was new? I mean, you just like, oh, well, that's new. That's a new idea. That's a breakthrough possibility.
Governor Rauner's budget address.
Yes, I'm sorry. Governor Rauner's speech, yes.
I would say he took a little bit more of a baby step toward compromising when he said that he acknowledges not all of his turnaround agenda needs to happen right away. So to me, that was a little bit more of him saying, all right, I'll back off on these poison pills of collective bargaining. I also think he didn't, I guess in his case, this is new, he did not attack public employee unions like he did just a few weeks ago at the State of the State address, and like he has done unwisely, in my opinion, as he's visited other places. He really did not attack public employee unions at all. But other than that, was there anything new? Not necessarily. I think he is drawing a line in the sand more clearly now and saying, you know, either untie my hands and let me cut the budget myself or get on board. And I think there will be a time clock ticking in his head, you know, shortly after the primary. If the legislature is still refusing to negotiate, he will just start cutting.
Well, he can do that. He's always been able to do that with the appropriations bills that the Democrats sent him a year ago. I don't know if those are still
alive. You know what, Eric? State law restricts so much of his discretion in that manner. So he actually does need the legislature to pass new statutes to untie his hands on things like Medicaid rates or a lot of these court orders. I mean, you can't really even touch DCFS because it's been under court order for 25 years because of, you know, juvenile violations. So there aren't really that many areas where he can just singularly go and strike out the budget, and he needs the legislature to allow him to do that.
What are the chances they're going to help him out on that, Kristen?
Probably zero. What? I mean, I don't, in my opinion, the legislature rules by Democrats, and with Mike Madigan sitting there and his daughter potentially waiting in the wings to run for governor, I just don't see them being willing to give him any sort of a victory.
Boy, there you go down that road again. You have 2 weeks in a row brought up the specter of his daughter wanting to be governor is shading Mike Madigan's actions. That's amazing to me.
Why?
Because that is so personal and literally petty compared to a state that's $6.5 billion in the hole. I mean, that's just ludicrous to me. I mean, I get it, but wow, that's the saddest thing 2 weeks in a row I've heard on this podcast.
Well, I think Kristen said last week wisely that we were saying, what's Madigan in it for? And right,
yeah.
Kristen, you said he's in it clearly just to keep the party in control.
Right. I mean, unless they can come to some sort of a compromise where Madigan and Cullerton also get to come out and sort of be not victorious, but where they all come out looking good, nothing's going to happen. And so I don't know how you compromise in a way that Madigan and Cullerton can come out and saying that they scored some victory points too. So I just think they're both going to be dug in, and neither side is going to budge.
Well, when we do our budgets at home, right, we have the needs and we have the wants, and sometimes we confuse the wants with the needs. And I hope you're right, Kristen, that he's going to throw away some of these union-busting provisions and focus on what really needs to be done now, like pension reform and workers' comp. I'll give you some of that, too. You know, if he would do that and focus on the absolute needs, not on his agenda's wants, I think a lot of people would be much more likely to jump on board with him.
Yeah, and I think that was part of what he said yesterday that was a little bit new. I mean, he has dropped right to work and some of these other things that animate the unions, But, I mean, Mike Madigan has to agree to sit down in a room and talk to him. And he doesn't even agree to do that. I mean, they haven't met since, I don't know, last fall. Hmm. And from my understanding, that's because the speaker doesn't show up.
Well, they were scheduled, but things just keep coming up, Kristen.
They got busy. Right. he had a dentist appointment that one time.
I mean, I continue to think that it is the governor's job to propose a budget that's balanced, and then it is the Democratic legislature's job to then take that, turn it into appropriations bills that are balanced, and send them back to the governor. That's the budgetary process. It ought not to involve all these other things, because if you want to start throwing in all these other issues, if the situation was reversed, you could have a Democratic majority saying, "No, a Democratic governor saying, "I'm not going to negotiate with you until you approve a graduated income tax or a millionaire's tax." Or until you change the gun laws. I mean, you can hold all these issues hostage to the budget, and I just don't think that they should. I think as a matter of principle, they should focus on this budget, get that done. Then they can work on these regulations and all those other things. I think that's got to be job two.
This is my last question about all that. Then I want to go on to the Apple FBI argument.
But I want to ask one quick one after you're done, though. Go ahead.
Well, this is my thing. Do you guys know the answer to what does pension reform mean? If I have a pension with the state of Illinois and I'm expecting a certain check every month, does pension reform mean we're going to say, guess what, we can't afford that anymore and you're going to get less money? Because if that's the case, I could see why that would be a very difficult pill for people to swallow. I know we can't afford it. We should have made some of these deals. But is that what we're telling these people that are getting pensions in Illinois, as long as they're alive, that guess what, we can't afford it and we're not going to pay you that much money anymore?
No.
I mean, the Supreme Court pretty much said that we are on the hook for all of those promises. The only pension reform that's on the table now is something that would allow workers to choose between two plans that are, pretty beneficial. And that's a plan that Cullerton is on board with, the governor's on board with. It could still go up to the Supreme Court and get knocked down. So that's the only proposal that's on the table. It basically deals with how big the raises are. So
and
people say it's not a diminishment because it's a choice and it's still generous.
Yeah, maybe too generous. But, you know, the state made the deal. I'd take it, I guess, if I could get it. What were you thinking, Steve?
Well, I know this sounds frivolous, but I'm genuinely interested in you guys and what you think of the governor's use of the...
Oh, here it comes. I know. Go ahead.
The G, dropping his G's. And, I anchored his speech yesterday on WGN Radio, and the second thing out of it that I said was, and frankly, the texts were overwhelming, was all about his elocution. And so I brought it up, and I was feeling a little guilty afterward, and I just wonder what you guys think, because on the one hand, I don't think you can fake that over and over, but on the other hand, as a guy who grew up on the fringes of downstate, when he says stuff like bankrupting, you know, I feel like he's talking down to me. I think he's thinking downstaters are kind of stupid, or this is how they talk, so this is how I'm going to get them on my side. And it just bothers me, but I could be completely wrong.
But he absolutely doesn't talk that way in private or in other settings.
Do we know? I don't know. I don't know how you could only do it in a speech.
There's
like
some
that.
Recordings of him back before he was a candidate, before he was a politician, when he was on Chicago Tonight, where he doesn't drop nearly as many G's. I actually count. He dropped 50. He dropped 51% of his G's yesterday. He did 62% in the State of the State. So he's actually improved a little bit.
So is it? What do you guys think? Is it legitimate? Is it fake?
Your colleague at WGN Radio, Ro Khan, made this an issue since his acceptance speech. He said, wait a minute, what's that? What's that? And it's made him kind of a laughingstock's not the right word, but it is so noticeable. You think he'd work on it. Maybe he is, Eric. I wouldn't know, Steve, since I don't, you know, he wasn't a public enough figure. I don't remember what he sounded like beforehand. I suppose it's possible a super duper rich guy drops his G's.
Kristen?
I mean, you asked the critical question, is this how he talked, you know, prior to being
right.
a candidate? And we don't really know that. I think it's both. I think he did sort of drop G's from the first few times that he came into the Tribune editorial board. And those are the only times I've interacted with him. He is this billionaire who speaks that way. But when he gets in front of an audience, I think he amps it up, or it's his way of trying to relate. I don't think it's condescending, because actually, I mean, Southern Illinois, they do speak differently. They have a Southern accent.
But so, when I go down there, I don't try to speak like them to get them to see things my way.
Well, it seems a miscalculation anyway, because most of the state isn't in Southern Illinois. I mean, if anything, he should talk like a Southsider, you know, if he really wanted to rally the troops. They talk in Madigan's district?
Do the Madigan-Lipinski, right.
So the FBI and Apple are having this argument. Evidently, Farouk, one of the San Bernardino terrorists, one of the shooters, has a cell phone, and it has software on it that if an incorrect password is tried 10 times, everything gets wiped and erased. There may be text messages, contacts, phone numbers on that phone that would lead to a more comprehensive investigation. So the FBI went to Apple and said, we want to know what's on there. We don't want to accidentally erase everything. Apple said, there is no such master key to open it up and get you that. The FBI said, invent it. And Apple said, we don't want to set that precedent, and we resent the even you asking. Who should win on this one? Should Apple cooperate, or should the FBI back off? Because it's a private company, and it would be harmful to Apple's brand if we all knew that now somewhere in a vault is the key to everything on our phone.
I always assumed that it was there.
I did too. It goes
against everything I've told my kids about the internet, right?
I know. Where's the NSA when you need them? But, you know, the NSA is metadata. They know who you – they may be able to track who you had been calling on that phone. But I don't. But remember, they always said, we won't be able to read your messages. I don't even know that we'll have your contacts per se, other than the ones that you specifically reached out to over some period of time. So maybe the NSA, with all of its scariness, can't crack the one phone we want them to crack. But in principle, what do you guys think about this? Whose side should you be on?
I think if the government with a court order can look at my my safety deposit box or my bank accounts or any other records like that, I don't think it's unreasonable that they can also look at what's on my phone.
Yeah. I understand the fear that once they create this way around their encryption that hackers can get into that. I think it's a legitimate fear. I don't have that. I share Steve's view. If the government has a legitimate reason and can get a court order to get into that kind of material, I think they should be able to as a matter of law enforcement. As far as the technical risk, I'm just not qualified to talk about it, but I do think that the government should be able to do that in situations like this.
Shows where their allegiance is. It's to their brand. It's not to this country. I don't know that that makes them monsters. I think that's probably almost where their allegiance should be.
Well, they might argue that their allegiance is to the country, and they're standing up for privacy, too.
What do you think, Kristen?
Well, predictably, I disagree with you. I don't think government should be able to force private enterprise to try to break its own code. From the techie stuff that I've read, they designed these products so that they would be, you know, the privacy standards would be very high. And so asking them to turn around then and somehow break a code that they say is unbreakable, they built this to be unbreakable, is the government asking too much. And let's not forget, the government screwed up by letting these people in the first place. And now they want to turn around and ask a private company to help clean up the mess.
The government screwed up how? What was the government's mistake?
The government allowed, the government did not pick up on, you know, openly social media cues about this woman. And so there's, to me, now they want to turn around and try to force a company to Bigfoot and like help them in their investigation in a way that I think oversteps the boundaries.
Well, but wait a minute. I mean, what if there's information on that phone that ties, that links them to other terrorists who are in this country? I mean, it's not just about
attack,
it's not just about bailing them out.
Or the murder of Antonin Scalia.
He pounces.
Yeah, or what if the information on there proved the guy innocent, too? I mean, you know, there's a number of ways to look at this. But I understand your point. I don't know that you and I are necessarily so far apart on this, Kristen. I think the other guys are saying opposite of what you're saying. I'm a little bit in the middle. I understand how it's at least inappropriate, I don't know, maybe wrong, for the government to tell a private company to fix, you know, to do something. Literally, Apple says that key doesn't even exist yet. And the government said, you need to figure it out. You have to do this. I don't recall an instance like this before. So it is, it's a strange story that way.
I'm glad they're fighting about it, though. I mean, I'm glad that Apple just didn't say, okay.
Well, I would have said okay, but not told anybody. I mean, like, think of how little harm would be done if Apple helped them open that phone, but we didn't know about it. If that just happened, and I'm in la-la land here, right? But I don't see the harm in doing it per se. It's the principle and the broader implications. But if we were able to insulate ourselves from that, not know, I feel about this the way I do the Jackie Robinson Little League residency requirement. If I just didn't know, I think I would be okay with it. Okay, time for our recommendations. This is where we ask everybody, what are you seeing, reading, watching, writing, listening to that you want everybody else to know a little bit about? Anybody want to go first on this? I didn't prep you guys.
I'll go first. I was at the University of Chicago Folk Festival last weekend playing music with people like I like to do down there. I was jamming, and this young woman started playing fiddle with me, and I found out who she was, and her name was Heather Maliuk, and she's got this band I discovered called Glass Mountain with her and Sarah Laginski and Ari Bolas. And they have this three young women, and they play Appalachian style folk music, and they do original stuff, and they're just wonderful. I went and bought their album online, and it was really terrific. So one of those little serendipitous moments that you get when you hang out with musicians.
Glass Mountain.
Glass Mountain, yes.
Nice shout out for them.
I'll keep the theme going if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
I feel great pressure from you guys to find something to talk about.
Yeah, this is the hardest part of the podcast.
It is for me. And so last night I watched the documentary about Glen Campbell, I'll Be Me, which has been out for a couple of years. You're familiar with it?
Yeah, I know the story, but I don't know
the
movie.
Okay, right. No. So he had come out with his album, and just as he did, he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And then he goes on this tour across country, and he played at Ravinia. He did a benefit here in Chicago during it. I think it was 2012. And the camera just follows him and then other musicians who are impacted by Alzheimer's. And it just shows Glen Campbell. First of all, it's incredibly revealing. And it shows him as this very sweet, affable sort of country boy kind of man. But he's incapable. I mean, he goes out on stage and they have to show him where to stand. They have a teleprompter in front of him with the lyrics. And if he starts to wander, they know it could go off the rails at any time. The film was made as a vehicle to increase awareness of Alzheimer's and to spur the government toward more funding for it. And I don't know who to recommend it to, because if you're aging, it must be scary as hell. But it just was such a bittersweet story.
How was the music in the show?
The music is good. You know, it's not like a retrospective on his career. You see some of the older stuff, but mostly it's about him. You know, and he's laughing on the bus, and he's loving his family. And then at another time, he is absolutely irate because he thinks his best friend has stole a golf club from him, and he hasn't. And he's fit to be tied and almost uncontrollable. Hmm. And all of this is just laid bare in this film. You know, a remarkable guy, and who's given us so much music, but he's leaving with a completely different but an equally remarkable gift.
What's the title of that again?
I'll Be Me. It's really worth seeing.
How about you, Kristen? Still down in Springfield. What's your recommendation this week?
Well, this is a column that I'm not sure if it ran in the Tribune. I saw it just online in the LA Times, but it's by Megan Dom, and it just talks a little bit more about Scalia's relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and just the larger picture that's actually applicable to our little podcast here. But it discusses a lot about, and I'll quote her here, the author, the idea that listening to another opinion can help fortify your own is almost unheard of these days. And it talks about the echo chamber of social media and just the intolerance for others' opinions and how the two of them really served as just a good example of how they fortified each other's opinions but managed to keep it civil. So it's by Megan Dom, and it's in the Los Angeles Times.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
No surprise coming from her.
Thank you. That was lovely, Kristen, and I'm not kidding about that. By the way, I went to JebBush.com this week to find a little bit more out about his policies. That URL's been hijacked, and it's a hyperlink now to Donald Trump's campaign page. How about that? If you go to JebBush.com, It takes you to Donald Trump's page. So then I started reading Donald Trump's stuff, and I started to read about his economic plan. It's got a tab there. And then I did it for Bernie Sanders, too. And this is just a call out to anybody who says, gosh, all of this political talk is interesting, but really trivial, right? The liar, liar calling and all of the silliness, really on both sides. But if you wanted to get into some of the serious issues, like really, who should we vote for? Read their tax policies. And so it's, I have been, and it's really interesting, and it's very simple. They don't get too detailed. It's not over your head, but you go to Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump's page or Jeb Bush, if you can find it, and they will lay out what they think the tax rates should be and what should happen to your deductions. And by the way, you'll love all of it because everybody is. Donald Trump said that I think 50% of the population will no longer pay taxes. And you know, Sanders is actually a little frightening, to be honest with you. It's pretty interesting. So just go to the website of the candidates, click on economic policies, read about their tax plans. It's very readable. It's very interesting. And if you crave a little substance and all of the cream you've been getting, well, there it is.
What is there's a organization in Washington that vets all these tax plans and tells you how much they're going to put us in the red. I don't know. I don't remember what it's called off the top of my head. But
yeah, no
once
kidding.
Once you read all those wonderful tax plans, go and see if you can get a reality check from some of these other stuff.
Well, let's do this. We're speaking spontaneously now, but as we post it, I'll ask Kristen Decker to put the URL, the website, for that one place that does sort of fact check the tax plans of these people. So there's a little assignment for you. Thank you, Eric, and thank you, Kristen. Kristen Decker is the producer of this podcast. We call it The Mincing Rascals. I'm John Williams. On Facebook, I'm King John, you know, and Saturdays I'm on WGN Radio from 1 to 3. Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio, Steve Bertrand on books. You hear him on WGN and at noontime each day. Eric Zorn writes a column for the Chicago Tribune, chicagotribune.com/Zorn. And they're going to bring her back from Springfield. Kristen McQuarrie is an editorial writer and columnist there, too. Thanks for your time and patience on the phone today, Kristen.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Okay, guys, that's it for this week. Thanks, Kristen Decker, our producer, and Bob Ferguson, our engineer. We are the Mincing Rascals.
Puddles of civility.
You little rascal, you. You little rascal, you.
The Mincing Rascals podcast is distributed by the WGN Plus Podcast Network. You can listen on the WGN Plus app or online at WGNPlus.com, or you can subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes. You're hearing music by Glass Mountain. Discover more at GlassMountainMusic.com.